Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods Market and Deli. Information at bloomingfoods.coop and goodsforcooks.com. Online at goodsforcooks.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Real food, green living.
Real food, green living.
Earth Eats.
Earth Eats.
Welcome, everybody. I'm Annie Corrigan. We're getting our hands dirty at a couple area farms in today's podcast. The folks of Mother Hubbard's Cupboard and Strangers Hill Organics give us an inside scoop into what makes an organic farm tick. Melon then takes center stage in two recipes as we make sweet yet light desserts. And we chat with Mrs. Q, or Sarah Wu, the school lunch crusader who recently revealed her identity as the teacher who documented her experience eating school lunches for 1 year. That's all coming up on Earth Eats. But first, here's Liz Leslie with a look at this week's news.
It's the week of foodies. No, not foodies like our fans, but food and the letter D, desserts and democracy. The Occupy Wall Street movement demands a democracy where the other 99% can be heard. So what does this have to do with food? The co-op model could address the disconnect between consumers and business. In a co-op, members have a say of how the profits are used. Potentially any business could be a co-op. Some common ones include housing, credit unions, and food. Food co-ops are often small, local, and community-owned. Participate in a democracy. Support your local co-op. Efforts to combat food deserts include food trucks and farmers markets, bringing fresh food where it's needed the most. What about adding fresh produce to an already existing staple in many urban communities, the convenience store? The Healthy Corner Stores Network encourages C-stores to stock fresh veggies and fruit. The initiative so far has been met with limited success, and store owners have to understand changing minds and food habits takes time. For those without transportation to a supermarket, the ability to put fresh produce on their table is welcome with open arms. You can read more news updates and get the latest in food news on our website, eartheats.org. And be sure to keep an eye out on our Twitter feed and on our Facebook page. Just search for Earth Eats. For Earth Eats, I'm Liz Leslie.
After one look at the bagel dog served to her in the Chicago Public School cafeteria where she worked, speech pathologist Sarah Wu's life was changed forever.
When I first ate that first school lunch, and I looked at the tray, and I almost got choked up because I worried about my students, and I couldn't believe that they were going to be eating a bagel dog. That was the meal that really left an impression.
A couple months later, she began a year-long project of eating the school lunch every day, photographing the meal and blogging about it under the anonymous pseudonym Mrs. Q at her website Fed Up With Lunch. Oh, and in case, like me, you've never experienced a bagel dog, it's apparently exactly what it sounds like, but mushy and soggy, delicious. On October 5th, after 21 months of anonymity, Wu revealed her identity in conjunction with the release of her book, Fed Up With Lunch. After having experienced school lunch from the inside, she has some definite ideas on how she thinks it should be changed. First of all, that pizza she ate, she found out it has 62 ingredients. Wu wants ingredient transparency.
I also would like to see lunch periods increase in terms of the time allowed. So, for example, at my school, it's 20 minutes. So a lot of the kids barely sit down. I mean, it can be a long line. It's just terrible that students like mine, who many of whom live below the poverty line, get what could be their best meal of the day and have somewhere between 9 and 13 minutes in which to eat it. You know, even in terms of their academics, how can you wolf down your lunch and then try and go up, you know, to your classroom after that and focus? It's just not good. So that would be something that I would really like to see. And then really I'd like to see nutrition education really make a comeback. But, you know, we really need to teach kids how to feed themselves. And it's beyond just saying you've got to eat broccoli because broccoli is good for your heart or whatever. Now we have to really get hands-on with food and have them make choices and learn, okay, this is what this vegetable looks like.
In conjunction with that, she also wants to see more salad bars included in school cafeterias. She says that giving kids the ability to choose their vegetables will empower them. She acknowledges, though, that schools have had a hard time implementing salad bars since First Lady Michelle Obama heralded their arrival in November 2010. Schools complain that they aren't sanitary and that the kids aren't eating what's on it, so a lot of food goes to waste.
There's a valid point in that you can't just plop a salad bar down in a school and just say, go at it. That's where the nutrition education has to come into play.
But it wasn't all bagel dogs and stale veggies for Wu. Since her adventure spanned a calendar year, she witnessed some changes to the school lunches from one school year to the next.
In the fall, I saw fresh veggies. I saw little bags of fresh broccoli, more salad, and it was in a little cup. And the kids that got salad in a little cup were pretty excited about the salad. I was actually pretty surprised by that. I wasn't sure what their reaction would be, but the kids were grabbing the salad.
Sarah Wu, formerly Mrs. Q, has a new book out called Fed Up with Lunch. Read my entire conversation with her on our website, eartheats.org. Strangers Hill Organics is the oldest continually certified organic farm in Indiana. So they've been fighting the good fight for a long time, the war on weeds. According to farm manager Rachel Beyer, weeds are probably the biggest challenge to organic farmers.
We call them non-crop competitors, a nice way of saying weeds. The things you can do are cultivate manually, so with a hoe or weeding by hand. You can also use black plastic mulch, which is, you know, you're not using a chemical, but you're still using a petroleum-based product to control your weeds, and then you throw it away at the end of the season. So it's, you know, difficult for some organic farmers to use, but it's major saving in terms of labor. The other mulching option is kind of what we're going to do in the herbs. After we get the plant matter out of there, we're going to do a deep mulch with cardboard and wood chips. That stuff will break down in the soil and you don't have to worry about removing it before you till, and you're adding soil organic matter while controlling the weeds at the same time. But that is way more labor intensive than just weeding by hand or using plastic mulch. So, yeah.
Well, and free labor from me today.
Great.
Which is,
yes.
Which is a
we
good
need
thing.
More of that.
That's right. I'm here to serve as an extra pair of hands in the field, specifically to save the parsley and thyme plants, which are being overtaken by weeds, like ragweed and a variety of grasses, and the especially pernicious vineweed. What the vineweed does is it wraps itself around plants and suffocates them and takes their nutrients. I'm told to make sure to remove the root of this weed because it'll just grow back if I don't.
As you can see, the difference in color and health between the ones that we just pulled the weeds out around and the ones that were weeded some time ago.
That's Ben Smith, CSA manager for Strangers Hill Organics and the man in charge of today's volunteer workday. He's providing some motivation by showing how healthy the parsley and thyme can look when they're free of non-crop competitors.
It's a darker green. It's just more lush. It's healthier. It probably tastes better, too, because it has all the nutrients it needs.
Do you ever think to yourself, if only we could use some pesticides to kill these darn weeds? Stupid organic farming!
It's funny, sometimes you find yourself doing the funniest things for organic farming. With conventional, you could just spray some Roundup on everything and it takes care of the problem. But what we're doing this for a reason. We're doing this because spraying those chemicals kills not just the bad plants, but it also kills the beneficial organisms. Even weeds, in a way, can be good. We don't kill every plant out here. We have bees on the farm, for example, and if we sprayed every plant that wasn't something we put in the ground here, there wouldn't be a whole lot of pollen to gather for those bees. You know, you see butterflies on this farm. You don't see butterflies on a monocultured cornfield, for example, because that's not a healthy ecosystem. It's not a diverse ecosystem.
Well, then, like, looking ahead to this plot of the farm, what are you guys going to do to just encourage more growth?
Putting down organic matter is a big one. So we save all the vegetables, all the fruits that we aren't able to use. We'll put it in the compost pile, let it break down, then bring it out here and put it on the fields. And if you do that for long enough, you can repair the ground to the point where it's just rich topsoil that is ideal for plant growth. It is ultimately extremely satisfying to know that what you're doing is not harming anything. And what you did today is going to feed people in the community. And that feels really good.
And I'm going to love this time.
It's going to taste really good. It's going to be the best tasting thyme you have ever had.
He was right. If you have other organic methods for controlling weeds, let us know by writing a comment on this post on our website. While you're there, see photos of Rachel Beyer and Ben Smith. It's all at eartheats.org. Growing food for the community is great, but for the folks at Mother Hubbard's Cupboard, their true passion is for education. And according to the Garden and Nutrition Education Program Coordinator Stephanie Solomon, their number one target is kids.
I mean, when it comes to health issues that a lot of low-income children in Indiana are facing, food-related, diet-related issues are amongst the top. And having a garden where kids are able to be active, connect with the earth, and get excited about the fresh foods that are coming from the garden was something that we were like, oh, this meets our mission really well.
I'm visiting her at the Butler Park Community Garden on 9th Street in Bloomington to talk about the organization's new hoop house and garden plot.
So how new is this?
Very, very new. They put it up in April. So the ground was broken.
It's taken a lot to turn this parkland into fertile soil. Being that the park was within city limits and right next to a railroad track, they were initially concerned about soil contaminants. No worries there. After the city did some thorough testing, the soil is perfectly clean, although like most of South Central Indiana, it's clay, which means it's dense and it doesn't drain well, and it takes a while to warm up in the spring. Not the best news, although Solomon can look on the bright side.
I always tell people in gardening classes, clay is not a horrible soil type to start with. There's actually a lot of nutrients in clay. You just have to add enough organic matter to kind of lighten it up and break them up and make it accessible to plants.
Think of it like this. A soil's tilth is basically how suitable it is for growing plants. And there are two ends of the soil tilth spectrum. You either have really sandy soil, in which everything just seeps right through, or you have clay soil where everything kind of gets stuck.
And so when you add more and more organic matter to clay soil, you're creating this humus, like this in-between, which is kind of the ideal soil tilth, where you can retain water, retain nutrients, but also have enough drainage for, so that you don't end up with a swamp.
Getting the organic matter into the ground in an organic way has taken them all season and will actually last through next spring when they're hoping to start planting their seeds.
The first part of the season, we started sheet mulching, which means we got as much manure and leaves and straw as we could and just layered to kind of break up the clay. And then we decided to put in the buckwheat cover crop just to make weed suppression a little easier and to have some more organic matter to turn into the ground. And so pretty much what will happen is we'll be turning the buckwheat into the soil and planting another cover crop.
It doesn't take quite as long to get things going in their new hoop house. These are greenhouses, basically, made of a sturdy frame with a special plastic covering. They absorb the heat and the light while protecting against wind and frost and extreme cold. Hoop houses can extend the growing season in both directions by allowing you to plant your seeds sooner in the spring and to continue to grow food for longer in the cold months.
So we're trying to get it ready for planting it next week with our cold crops.
Like kale, collard greens, Swiss chard, other types of leafy greens. All the planting and soil preparation is being done by volunteers from the community, including some young people. Solomon says she's not quite sure what to expect in terms of how much heat the hoop house will retain.
We're thinking of putting some 50-gallon barrels or drums in it filled with water to retain some heat. And then we're going to follow Elliot Coleman's winter gardening example where you have the hoop house, but then within the hoop house you do a low tunnel. And so essentially you have another layer in the hoop house. So it's like a mini hoop house in the hoop house. So during the really intense cold of the winter, you can keep your plants alive. Our plan is to have seeds starting in here in the spring. So have shelves up for seeds starting, and then have worm bins like they do at Growing Power in Milwaukee. Yeah, I know, it's so exciting.
We'll be following Stephanie Solomon throughout the winter and early spring to see how the garden and hoop house are progressing. Read more about Mother Hubbard's Cupboards gardening project in the Butler Park Community Garden and see photos on our website, eartheats.org. We'll scrub our hands clean of all the dirt from working in the garden and move into the kitchen now. The stars of our two recipes today are cantaloupe and honeydew. We may be reaching the end of peak melon season, but Chef Daniel Orr says that's okay.
This actually works with kind of those winter melons too, because we're making a syrup to go over them. So if the melons aren't really quite sweet enough, this will actually make them taste better than they actually are. All right, so what I like to do when I'm squeezing limes is just put a fork in and then twist, and that way you get a lot more juice out of it, and then you can just kind of squeeze that down and you really get a maximum amount of lime juice out of that because the fork actually breaks up all those little membranes.
And I see that you've sort of sliced off the zest already.
Right, we've zested them already, so that's going to be in the syrup at the end.
So the juice and the zest.
Right, the juice is the acidic part and the zest will give us the perfume. All right, so we're going to throw this in a pot with some sugar. Need about 2 cups.
Oh, it's a lot.
And then we're going to throw in our ginger. We've got chopped ginger. If you ever want to peel ginger, you can just take a fork or a spoon and just rub that peel right off. That's a very quick, easy way to peel ginger. All right, and we're also just going to add about 1.5 cups of water. And we're just going to bring this to a boil, let the sugar liquefy, and then we'll toss it all together with the zest and the fruit. Now I'm going to bring the syrup over, and while it's still nice and hot, I'm going to add my lime zest. And I didn't want to put that in earlier because I want it to stay nice and green. And we're just going to sprinkle the syrup over the top of the fruit salad and pop it in the fridge. The hot syrup on the ripe fruit will kind of bruise it and give it a very intense flavor. And this is great. We'll have leftover syrup. I know that was a lot of sugar, but we're going to have plenty of syrup, and we can use this in all different things. You could make cocktails with it. You could use it on other different types of fruit, even use it in marinades and things. All right, and that's as simple as it gets.
Our next recipe uses a lot of the same ingredients, but make sure you have a heavy-duty blender on hand. It'll make the prep process that much easier.
We're going to make a really simple soup. A lot of people, you know, they don't like to have dessert. They're looking for lighter alternatives. They don't want to have cakes. They don't want to bake. This is a great dessert for people that don't really want dessert.
I don't know all right? People.
So we have our trusty blender again. We've got some ripe melon. You could use honeydew or cantaloupe. I'm using honeydew today. You know why the melons got married, right?
I have no idea.
Because they cantaloupe.
Nice, nice.
All right, so we got our melon in there. We've got some orange juice, about 1.5 cups. For our adults, we've got a nice cup of white wine, dry white wine. We're going to add a little bit of lime juice for acidity. And then honey's going to be our sweetener. Now, I like honey for this because you don't have to dissolve sugar. You could also use something like agave nectar, or, you know, if you have a flavored simple syrup that you'd like, you could do that. We're just going to put this on and blend it. Okay, and that's all there is to it. Now we're going to garnish the soup. We're going to add some mint and some lime zest.
And you're going to serve this cold then?
Serve it cold, right. We're going to put a little bit of ice cream in it today, so it's going to be a kind of a sweet dessert soup. And you can always put just a little pinch of salt in that. That'll bring out the flavors.
Remind me what you're chopping up here.
This is mint. I've got several different varieties. I've got kind of a curlicue mint and a peppermint.
Are you having success with mint in your garden this year?
Oh, the mint just goes crazy. Yeah. You have to keep it confined. It likes to be restricted. All right, we're going to stir this up. Ladle it. I like to use white bowls because they kind of make a nice frame around the soup. And we've got a nice scoop of ice cream.
Oh, look at that.
We'll put some blackberries. And that's such a simple dessert. Fresh, tasty, healthy. Enjoy.
Two fruity desserts to enjoy before the melons retreat for the season. Check out the recipes and photos of the finished dishes on our website. Chef Orr has a bunch of other recipes for you to look at and get ideas from. For instance, if that simple syrup really hit the spot for you, check out the thyme and lime syrup and the mint and orange syrup. It's all at eartheats.org. Thanks, as always, to Chef Daniel Orr for the tasty eats today. Liz Leslie and Sarah Gordon write our news stories. And Sia Africa and Aobon Binder help keep eartheats.org in tip-top shape. From all the folks here at Earth Eats, we thank you for listening. I'm Annie Corrigan. Cheers.